choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Get my feet out. Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
So in that baby light, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 128. Of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo Mission Control, Christopher Columbus Craft, Part 2. Before we return to Chris Craft's career, I wanted to cover a little of Craft's personal life. In 1950, Craft was married to his wife, Betty Ann Turnbull. They met in high school. They had two children, Gordon and Christy Ann. In his autobiography, Craft recognizes the sacrifices that his family made as a result of his work for NASA, saying that, quote, "I was more of a remote authority figure to Gordon and Christy Ann than a typical American father. They all had my mother to fill some of the void, but it wasn't the same. Still, I don't know what I could have done differently. My nation called, I answered. All of us did our jobs, Gordon and Christy Ann too, though they'd be adults before they understood." End quote. Craft's religion is Episcopalian. At his local church, he served as a lay reader, which meant he was authorized by a bishop in the Anglican Communion to lead certain services of worship or lead certain parts of a service. During the 60s, the Craft family was deeply involved in church activities. Betty Ann taught Sunday school and served on the Altar Guild. Gordon was an acolyte, and Christy Ann sang in the choir. In addition to his duties as a lay reader, Craft spent some time teaching a class in adult Bible study. As he recounts, however, quote, "I lacked the fundamentalist fervor and drove people away when I tried too hard to relate the early church to more modern interpretations. It was hard not to be modern when I spent my working days sending men into space," end quote. Craft has been an avid golfer ever since he was introduced to the game in the 1940s by his friends and NASA colleague, Sig Soberg. He cited the good golfing as a reason for staying in Houston after his retirement. Now, returning to Craft's professional life, at a speaking engagement in 2001, Craft was asked what he did.
I think that what we tried to do is figure out all of the things that could go wrong and be prepared to deal with them, and we call those mission rules. And we wrote all the procedures, both for ourselves and the astronauts, and call those malfunction procedures. So we each knew what was expected of each other. We depended on each other. We integrated the astronauts into doing the job in space, and we did the job on the ground to keep them there and to accomplish the mission. A little different than you do when you're at Cape Canaveral. At Cape Canaveral, when you're preparing a spaceship and something goes wrong, you're trying to figure out how to fix it. It's a little different for the flight control team because they don't have any spares around in a spaceship in those days to fix the equipment, so we had to try to figure out how to accomplish the mission even though the equipment was malfunctioning. Fortunately,
Craft was also asked which flights he was flight director on.
I was the flight director for all of the Mercury missions and the first seven Gemini missions. I was the director of flight operations up till Apollo 13, and then I was the deputy director of the Johnson Space Center, and then I was the director of the Johnson Space Center from 72 to 82 while we developed and flew the first shuttles.
Kraft served as flight director during all six of the manned Mercury missions. Only during the final flight, Mercury Atlas 9, which lasted for over a day, did he share responsibility with his deputy, John Hodge. When Kraft was asked what it was like working with the pressure of the space race, he replied,
"Well, I'd be foolish to say it put no pressure on us, because it certainly did, but the pressure was good, not bad. Particularly in retrospect, I think that when you have the demands of the program, when you have the demands of a goal, when you get the commitment and dedication that that brings from the people involved, you actually get more out of the people than you would ever gotten under any other circumstances. So that truly was a wonderful experience to go through, because people were giving you 110% of what they their capabilities were, and their capabilities improved every day. As a result of that. And so I don't think that we saw it at the time as being any great pressure. We wanted to beat the Russians into space, and that was a very big disappointment to us that we didn't. But we also wanted to beat them to the moon, and we did that in spades. So that was a very exhilarating feeling. But the time period that we worked in the 60s was really a great time. And I, for one, knew it was a great time, and that was a very fortunate thing, because I enjoyed every moment of it. And I think everybody that worked in the program enjoyed it. They put away their petty differences, and they worked very, very hard at getting the job done. That was wonderful.
Now I want to cover a couple of manned missions that Kraft was flight director on. First, Mercury Atlas 6, the flight of John Glenn. Now, that was a testing experience both for Mission Control and for Kraft. Mercury Atlas 6 was the first orbital flight by an American. The flight went normally until Glenn began his second orbit. At that point, Kraft's system controller, Dan Arabian, reported that telemetry was showing a segment 51 indicator. This suggested that the capsule's landing bag, which was meant to deploy upon splashdown in order to provide a cushion, might have deployed early. Kraft believed that the segment 51 indicator was on due to faulty instrumentation rather than an actual early deployment. However, if he was wrong, it would mean that the capsule's heat shield, which fitted on top of the landing bag, was now loose. A loose heat shield could cause the capsule to burn up during reentry. Upon consulting with his flight controllers, Kraft became more convinced that the indication was false and that no action was needed. However, Kraft's superiors, including Mercury capsule designer Max Faget, felt differently. They overruled Kraft, telling him to instruct Glenn to leave the capsule's retro rocket package on during reentry. The reasoning was that the package, which was strapped over the heat shield, would help hold the heat shield in place if it was loose. Kraft, however, felt that this was an unacceptable risk. He believed that if any fuel was left in any of the three retro rockets, a fatal explosion could occur. Faget told Kraft all the fuel was burned. Kraft reluctantly agreed to follow the plan advocated by Faget and by Walt Williams, his superior in the flight operations division. The retro rockets would be kept on. Of course, Glenn landed safely, but an inspection of his capsule revealed that one of the landing bag switches had been faulty. Kraft was right. The heat shield had not been loose after all. Kraft swore that his decision as a flight director would not be overruled again. Kraft's assistant on the mission was Gene Kranz. He considered Glenn's flight to be a turning point in Kraft's evolution as a flight director. Kraft believed his flight control team was superior to the designers at real-time integrated space systems analysis. Years later, Kraft was asked what his proudest moment in the space program was. And even though he had been overruled on this flight, it was mentioned as one of his proudest moments. Here's the clip.
I had many proud moments. I don't think I could single out any one proud moment. That would be extremely difficult for me to do. I think Alan Shepard was certainly a flight where I learned to be a flight director, because until you put a human being on the end of a rocket, you don't really understand the problem. And I was pretty nervous. I was pretty exhilarated when it was over, as was Alan Shepard. Certainly Glenn's flight was a great flight for all of us. And then each one got better. Apollo 8 was probably my most exhilarating moment, because I was the guy that had talked the management into putting the vehicle around the moon and then in orbit around the moon, and that's a little bit different than just going around it. So it had to work going in, and it had to work coming out, and that was pretty exciting and pretty demanding on my heart, I suppose.
As I mentioned before, after John Glenn's flight, Kraft vowed that he would no longer allow his decisions as flight director to be overruled by anyone outside mission control. The mission rules, whose drafting had been overseen by Kraft, stated that the flight director may, after analysis of the flight, choose to take any necessary action required for the successful completion of the mission. For Kraft, the power that the flight director held over every aspect of the mission extended to his control over the actions of the astronauts. In his 1965 interview with Time magazine, he stated that, quote, "The guy on the ground ultimately controls the mission. There's no question about that in my mind, or in the astronauts' minds. They're going to do what he says," end quote. The other Mercury mission I want to cover is Mercury Atlas 7, Scott Carpenter's flight. Kraft objected to the choice of Scott Carpenter as the astronaut for this flight because of his lack of flight test hours compared with the rest of the group, his lack of interest in Kraft's mission control program, and his lack of engineering skills. The mission suffered from problems, including an unusually high rate of fuel usage, a malfunctioning horizon indicator, a delayed retrofire for reentry, and a splashdown that was 460 kilometers downrange from the target area. Throughout the mission, Kraft found himself frustrated by the vagueness of Carpenter's communications with mission control and what he perceived as Carpenter's inattention to his duties. Kraft believed that Carpenter either didn't understand his instructions or was ignoring his instructions. While some of these problems were due to mechanical failures, too many science experiments and responsibility for some of the others is still debated, Kraft did not hesitate to assign blame to Carpenter and continued to speak out about the mission for decades afterwards. In his autobiography, the chapter that dealt with the flight of Mercury Atlas 7 was titled, "The Man Malfunctioned." In a letter to the New York Times, Carpenter called the book vindictive and skewed and offered a different assessment of the reasons for Kraft's frustration. Carpenter wrote, "In space, things happen so fast that only the pilot knows what to do, and even ground control can't help. Maybe that's why he is still fuming after all these years," end quote. After the flight, Kraft spoke to his friend, Deke Slayton and persuaded him to agree that Scott Carpenter would never fly in space again. With the beginning of the Gemini program, Mission Control moved to Houston. In 2001, Kraft was asked why Houston was chosen. His answer was typical of Kraft.
Initially, I'd have to say that the Johnson Space Center, as it is known today, arrived in Houston because of the politics. When you have Lyndon Johnson as the president and the other congressman from Texas, then it's all, I was getting a regular to Tiger, but Albert Thomas is the gentleman I was trying to think of, because Albert Thomas was head of the Appropriations Committee at the time. And certainly we arrived in Texas because they had a lot to do with it, and that's where we ended up. There were seven cities being considered, and if you had asked us to rank them in the program, we'd have put Texas seventh. After we got there, we put Texas first, because I think it has been very good for us. But a more direct answer to your question is, when this thing lifts off the pad, you could be in Timbuktu and it wouldn't make any difference, because from then on you're dependent upon communications lines from around the world as it flies either around the world or out into deep space. So it really doesn't make any difference where the control center is. We wanted the control center where it was after we moved to Texas, because we wanted the flight control people, the astronauts, and the engineers that built it to work together to build the best machine.
With the beginning of Apollo, Kraft expected to return to his role in Mission Control. He would have been lead flight director on the first manned Apollo mission, later known as Apollo 1, if not for the accident. As the Apollo missions progressed, occasionally Kraft intervened in order to ensure that his conception of the flight director's authority was maintained. By the time that the Apollo 7 mission flew, he had been promoted to head of flight operations. Thus, it was Glenn Looney who served as lead flight director and had to deal directly with behavior by the crew that Kraft considered insubordinate. As Kraft commented in his memoirs, quote, "It was like having a ringside seat at the Wally Schirall complaint circus," end quote. Mission commander Wally Schirall, annoyed by last-minute changes in the crew's schedule and suffering from a bad head cold, repeatedly refused to accept orders from the ground. The worst was the crew's refusal to put their helmets back on for re-entry, because Schirall was concerned that the crew's head cold in combination with pressurized suits during re-entry would rupture their eardrums. After the flight, once again, Kraft consulted with his friend Deke Slayton, and they decreed that the Apollo 7 crew would never fly in space again. As the director of flight operations, Kraft was closely involved in planning the broad outlines of the program. He was one of the first NASA managers to become involved in the decision to send Apollo 8 on a circumlunar flight. Due to problems with lunar module development in 1968, NASA faced the possibility of a full Apollo test mission being delayed until 1969. As a substitute, George Lowe, the manager of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office, came up with the idea of assigning a new mission profile to Apollo 8, one that could be flown without the lunar module. The idea was discussed in early August at a meeting between Lowe, Kraft, Gilruth, and Deke Slayton. Lowe's plan was to fly in December, which left little time for Flight Operations Division to train and prepare. After agreeing that the mission was possible in principle, Kraft went to his mission planners and flight directors in order to determine whether they and their teams could be ready within the tight schedule that was projected. In August of 1968, Apollo 8 was given final approval by James Webb. In planning for Apollo 8, one of the responsibilities Kraft faced was ensuring that a fleet would be waiting to recover the crew when they splashed down at the end of the mission. This proved an unusual challenge because much of the Pacific Fleet of the U.S. Navy would be on leave over Christmas and New Year's Eve. Kraft had to personally meet with Admiral John McCain in order to persuade him to make the requisite resources available to NASA. On Christmas Eve, 1968, Apollo 8 went into orbit around the moon. Only 10 years earlier, Kraft had joined Gilruth's newly found Space Task Group. Now the two men sat together in Mission Control, reflecting on how far they had come. Around them, the room was filled with cheers, but Kraft and Gilruth separated more quietly. Kraft recalled, quote, "It was glorious pandemonium, and through the mist in my own eyes, I saw Bob Gilruth wiping at his and hoping that no one saw him crying. I put my hand on his arm and squeezed. He lifted my hand from his arm and shook it strongly. There were no words from either of us. The lumps in our throats held them back." Kraft again found himself a spectator during the landing of Apollo 11, which he viewed from Mission Control, sitting with Gilruth and George Lowe. He played a more active role in events during the unfolding of the Apollo 13 crisis. Called into Mission Control by Gene Kranz almost immediately after the accident, Kraft chaired the meeting of senior managers which decided the mode that Apollo 13 would use to return to Earth. Many Apollo engineers, later to become top managers themselves, considered Kraft to have been one of the best managers in the program. He personally handpicked and trained an entire generation of NASA flight directors, including John Hodge, Glenn Lunny, and Gene Kranz, the last of whom referred to Kraft simply as the teacher. Kraft could, however, be a tough taskmaster, making it clear that there was no place in the flight operations division for those who failed to live up to his exacting standards. Kraft is quoted as saying, quote, "To err is human, but to do so more than once is contrary to flight operations directorate policy," end quote. Subordinates who seriously displeased Kraft could find themselves deprived of the opportunity to make it up to him. Kraft possessed the power to end careers at Johnson Space Center. As mission controller Cy Liebergott recalled, quote, "If he was behind you, you had as much leverage as you needed. If he was against you, you were dead meat," end quote. In 1969, Kraft was named deputy director of the Manned Spacecraft Center. On January 14, 1972, he became the director of MSC, replacing Gilruth, for whom Kraft had worked since his arrival at Langley in 1945. Space commentator Anthony Young has described Kraft as a superb successor to Gilruth, second only to him in the history of center directors. During his retirement, Kraft has consulted for numerous companies, including IBM and Rockwell International. Kraft has received numerous awards and honors for his work. These include the NASA Outstanding Leadership Medal, 4 NASA Distinguished Service Medals, the Distinguished Citizen Award given to him by the city of Hampton, Virginia in 1966, the John J. Montgomery Award in 1963, and the Goddard Memorial Trophy awarded by the National Space Club in 1979. In 1999, Kraft received the National Space Trophy from the Rotary National Award for Space Achievement Foundation, which described him as, quote, a driving force in the U.S. human spaceflight program from its beginnings to the space shuttle era, a man whose accomplishments have become legendary, end quote. In 2006, NASA gave Kraft the Ambassador of Exploration Award, which carried with it a sample of lunar material brought back from Apollo 11. Kraft, in turn, presented the award to his alma mater, Virginia Tech, for display in its College of Engineering. In 2011, the Johnson Space Center renamed its Mission Control Center the Christopher C. Kraft Jr. Mission Control Center in his honor. Kraft Elementary School, located in Hampton, Virginia, near Kraft's hometown, was named for him. More than any other single person, Kraft has been responsible for shaping the organization and culture of NASA's Mission Control. As his protege, Glenn Lunny, commented, quote, the Control Center today is a reflection of Chris Kraft, end quote. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 128 of the Space Rocket History Podcast, entitled Apollo Mission Control, Christopher Columbus Kraft, Part 2. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. Hope you enjoyed the episode. It was my pleasure to bring it to you. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed, and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. And a special salute today to my Rocket Emoticon donors. Thank you for your continued support. As you may know, to earn a Rocket Emoticon, you must donate to the podcast 2 years in a row. I'd like to remind everyone that episodes 121 through 128 are now available on YouTube. I put the link to the videos on Facebook, Twitter, and the homepage with the episode posting. Now, if you can, stick around for the entire episode, because I do have some bonus material at the end. I had a couple of afterthoughts on this week's episode. Chris Kraft certainly had an amazing career and life, and deserves high praise for his service to his country and mankind in general. Of course, like everyone else, there were certain personality conflicts that I wish did not happen. I think Kraft got off on the wrong foot with Wernher von Braun. Robert Gilruth kind of primed the pump with the negative comments he had made about von Braun. There is a story in Kraft's autobiography about his first meeting with von Braun, which became an argument and almost a fist fight. Kraft did not appreciate what von Braun said about his mission control program, and von Braun didn't really care what Chris Kraft thought at all. Anyway, you can read it for yourself in his book. The title is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. Another thing that amazed me was Kraft's power to influence Deke Slayton, specifically with the grounding of astronauts because of what Kraft perceived as insubordination. Yet Kraft himself was very nearly insubordinate on John Glenn's flight, and vowed, after that flight, to be insubordinate on all future flights when anyone, including his superiors, tried to overrule his flight decisions. It seemed to be a bit of a double standard, but that's just my opinion, which really doesn't mean anything at all. There were a couple of audio clips that I really couldn't fit anywhere in the episode, so I wanted to play them here. And let me apologize for the audio quality. There's a lot of background noise going on. This was at NASA in 2001, I think it was, and Chris was there answering some questions and signing his book. So sorry about the background noise. In the first clip, a child asked Kraft if the astronauts still drank Tang. Here's what he said.
I'm sure the astronauts still drink orange juice, but I don't think they ever thought much of Tang.
But Chris, that's not what the commercial said. I can remember as a child I used to love drinking Tang because I was told that that was what the astronauts drank. This is kind of hurtful a little bit. Anyway, the next clip is Kraft answering the question, why we haven't landed on Mars.
They haven't landed on Mars yet because we don't have the inspirational leadership in this country to allow us to spend the money to go. I would be hopeful, young man, that if you really want to answer to that question, that you become a congressman or a senator and vote us the funds. I hope I'm still alive to spend them, but I doubt it.
You are exactly right, Mr. Kraft. We never had the funding or leadership at the same time to go to Mars. And I hope he does get to see it. I hope I get to see it. Chris Kraft should be about 91 years old now, and as far as I know, he's still among the living. Moving on, I have posted several pictures for this episode on the website, spacerockethistory.com. Hope you check them out, and you certainly want to see Chris Kraft and his mentees as well. And if you would like to have those pictures emailed to you immediately after the podcast is complete, you can sign up for the email list on the homepage. It's on the right column of the page and is called Subscribe to Blog by Email. Have some additional bonus content at the end of the episode, so make sure you continue listening. I was pleased to receive 5 donations to support the podcast this week. Greg R. from Michigan donated at the Apollo level. Thank you, Greg. Greg G. from Australia continued his support at the Apollo level for 2015. And since that is the second year in a row he's donated, he is awarded the Rocket Emoticon. James N. from Brooklyn donated at the Vostok level. Stephen M. from California donated at the Sputnik level, and Robin P. pledged on Patreon at the Vostok level. Also want to thank all my Patreon supporters for honoring their pledge this month. And speaking of Patreon, you may not have heard, but I have set a goal of reaching 50 Patreons by the end of the year. We are currently at 19. So I was hoping that some of you haven't donated yet, those of you who have not made a donation yet, might consider making a one-time donation now or signing up at Patreon. The nice thing about Patreon is a lot of people can donate a little bit of money on a monthly basis. For instance, $1 a month, $2 a month, something like that. I put out about 4 new shows a month on average, and that works out to be maybe 25 cents per episode if you give $1 per month. If you can afford that, I would appreciate it. To sign up at Patreon, go to my homepage, spacerockethistory.com. Click on the Patreon link, and it is on the right side of the page, the second one down. Now, if you would rather be poked in the eye with a sharp stick than pledge at Patreon, would you consider making a one-time donation? To do that, click on the Donate button on the homepage on the right side of the page. Donation of $5 will get your name on the donors page at the Sputnik level. Either one of those methods is fine with me, and we're just trying to set a goal of reaching 50 Patreon subscribers by the end of the year. That's the goal, so that's why I say that one first, but any method of donation is fine with me. To stay updated on the podcast, please follow me on Twitter and Facebook. The links are on the homepage. I want to thank those who follow me on Twitter and as well as those who liked the Facebook page this week. Should you need to contact me, my email is mike@spacerockethistory.com. And I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. Thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, Buddy P. Murphy, Stephen Lebowski, Kadavi 1202, Ozzy Photo Guy, R.G. Eggenhofer, Skibby, Glenn Trudgett, 1202 Alarm, Star Warsified, Hello Greedo, Alley 2000. I really appreciate it. If I missed anyone, let me know and I'll get you next week. Now, for everyone who stuck around to the end, I have a couple of Chris Kraft bonus items. Here's the first. In 1994, Kraft was appointed chairman of the Space Shuttle Management Independent Review Team, a panel made of leading aerospace experts whose task was to investigate ways in which NASA could make its space shuttle program more cost-effective. The panel's report, known as the Kraft Report, was published in February 1995. It recommended that NASA space shuttle operations should be outsourced to a single private contractor, and that NASA should consider progression toward the privatization of the space shuttle. It also criticized the effect of safety changes made by NASA after the Challenger accident, saying that they had created a safety environment that was duplicative and expensive. Fundamental to the report was the idea that the shuttle had become a mature and reliable system, about as safe as today's technology will provide. The report was controversial even at the time of its publication. John Pike, Space Policy Director for the Federation of American Scientists, commented that the Kraft Report was a recipe for disaster. Further, he said, they are basically saying dismantle the safety and quality assurance mechanisms set in place after the Challenger accident. NASA's Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel also took issue with the report, saying in May 1995 that the assumption that the space shuttle systems are now mature smacks of complacency, which may lead to serious mishaps. Nonetheless, NASA accepted the recommendations of the report, and in November 1995, responsibility for the space shuttle operations was turned over to the United Space Alliance. 9 years later, the Kraft Report was again criticized, this time by the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, as part of its consideration of the organizational and cultural causes of the Columbia accident. According to the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, the Kraft Report contributed to the undesirable safety culture within NASA, allowing NASA to view the shuttle as an operational rather than experimental vehicle, and distracting attention from continuing engineering anomalies. And the final item I have comes from a very inspirational speech Chris Kraft made in 2009.
I want to spend the rest of my time tonight talking a little bit about the problems that NASA is struggling with today, because I think that's important. First, in 1915, the NACA was established, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And I want you to know that something like 80 to 100% of the vehicles that are in this museum had their roots in the NACA. I want to think about that. All of these flying machines that you see around you had their roots in the NACA. Now, the NASA programs that we did in the 60s had a great deal of payoff. We didn't invent everything that happened in Apollo, but it was the demands of the products, of the perfection, of the reliability, of the performance, of the mass, of the reduction in power that brought about a spike and, in my opinion, the greatest advancement in the state of the art in technology in the history of man. It was the NASA programs that drove that. So I say we can call that return on investment. Every company in the United States has a capital expenditure. I've served on a number of boards, and that's our whole life. Their whole future depends on making an investment with capital funds every year. And they're looking for a return on investment. NASA is the best return on investment that this country has ever seen, and is today the best government agency to get a return on investment. And it is where our future lies. So the point I want to make is that we need to make an investment in new technology in NASA. There are all kinds of ways to use that technology. Everybody's got his ideas, and Buzz will tell you a bunch of them tonight about how to get there and how to use it. There are a lot of other people that do that. But what we need is new technology. We have not made that investment since Apollo. All the programs that NASA has had has demanded that they spend the money on the programs as opposed to putting money into technology for the future. In Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, we spent about 10% of our monies on the future. Fuel cells, thermal protection systems, the communication satellite and computers changed the whole world in which we live. That's what we need today. We need an investment in the future and a return on investment which we can see and provide to the country. So I say to Mr. Obama, let's get on with it. Let's invest in the future.
That concludes the bonus material. Hope to have episode 129 ready by next Thursday. So long for now.